Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. 2018 was a big year for strikes and efforts to unionize. In February, more than 20,000 teachers and school employees went on strike in West Virginia, which inspired educators across the country to follow suit. Teachers in Los Angeles are currently in a contract dispute. Depending on what happens, Los Angeles teachers could strike for the first time in nearly 30 years. In September, McDonald's workers went on strike over sexual harassment and low wages. And then a month later, fast food workers across the board walked off the job to demand union rights and a $15 minimum wage. More than 7,000 workers at Marriott hotels in eight cities went on strike, saying one job should be enough. In San Francisco, the strike continued for 2 months before Marriott settled. In fact, Marriott has settled in many cities across the country, eight cities, in fact, recently signed new contracts after workers went on strike for raises and affordable health care. And then just last week, mental health workers at Kaiser Hospitals in California participated in a five-day strike to draw attention to the long wait times their patients experience. Some people have to wait up to 2 months for a follow-up therapy appointment. Kaiser's mental health workers are also demanding better working conditions. So what did these workers win? What will the legacies of 2018's labor strikes be for workers in these and other industries? And what is to come in 2019? Today, we are joined by Eric Loomis, Associate Professor of History at the University of Rhode Island and author of the forthcoming book, A History of America in 10 Strikes. Hi, Eric. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. A little later on in the show, we will be joined by workers from Kaiser and Marriott. But Eric, we wanted to bring you on. We're going to talk with you about your book that's about to come out in the next couple of months, A History of America in 10 Strikes. Based on the work that you did for that book, looking at the history of strikes, what really stands out for you when you look at what was accomplished this year?
Yeah, well, I guess the first thing I'll say is that the book is actually out now. It's been out since October, so you can get it if you were to. But oh yeah, no. But you know, I mean, I think that you know, I think there's a lot going on right now. I think that we're in a position where, you know, despite a lot of claims about a great economy and low unemployment and everything else, you know, the economy is not working that well for most Americans. And a lot of Americans, you know, they don't have a lot of economic security or necessarily a great belief that the future is going to be better for them or better for their children. So, I right now we're at a position, I think, where there's a lot of belief that the system doesn't necessarily work. And even though this is, you know, not the greatest time for organized labor in the history of America, and in fact, really a quite terrible time in many ways, you know, people are returning to the idea of strikes as a tactic to demand broad-based changes, not just about wages per se, but also about communities. And I think that one thing many of these strikes have in common is their basis around the community, about not only standing up for yourself and, you know, demanding that you don't have to work a second job, but also connecting those demands to doing a good job on your one job. And because so many of these jobs today in our modern economy are in the service industry or in education, they're about interacting with other people. And I think building those communities is really helping garner support for these strikes.
Yeah, that's such a good point. When we hear the new unemployment numbers, we rarely hear information about what kinds of jobs are actually being created and how much they pay. And so much data shows that a vast majority of the new jobs being created don't pay very well, and they don't provide any benefits whatsoever.
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, too many of our policymakers and certainly our media is driven by rather shallow views of the economy and numbers. And so, you know, you have this unemployment rate, and sure, the unemployment rate is presently fairly low, but how many of these people have two jobs or three jobs? How many are underemployed?
Right.
You know, how many are not able to spend time with their children because they can't because they have to work a second job? how many of them are on time or are on call scheduling where they don't even know what their schedule is going to be week to week? How many are unable to have, they may be working, but how many are unable to afford childcare? And those are the actual measures of a healthy economy, not the stock market, not the GDP, and certainly not a basic unemployment rate. So I think that there's a big disconnect between how the media talks about and certainly how policymakers talk about the economy versus how everyday people live the economy. And these strikes are a big part of that.
Eric, in your book, A History of America in 10 Strikes, what really stood out for you in terms of how unions operated in the past and how they operate today?
Well, I think that a few things. I mean, I think that the one lesson from the book that is probably maybe the most relevant for today isn't necessarily so much about how unions have operated. They've operated in many, many different ways. But I think that there's a really deep relationship between the success of a workers' movement and the role of the government. For way too much of American history, really for most of American history, government and employers have united to crush any kind of workers' rights movements. And we're starting to see that again today. So you have the Janus case, you know, which creates a right to work, so-called right to work, in public sector unions that allows people to basically leech off of their colleagues who are covered by the same contract but aren't paying into, being made to pay into the union. And this is just one example of how the government is stepping in to undermine anything workers do that might be successful in terms of organizing. And that's a reality of what we have to face today. And it looks a whole lot more like 100 years ago than it did like the great union period of the 1950s. I would say that go ahead.
Well, since you brought up Janus, let's just talk about that for a minute. Just to remind everyone, the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that unions may not collect fees from non-member workers, even if they benefit from the union's collective bargaining efforts. And, you know, in media outlets across the board, worker organizers say that the decision means that unions will lose members, lose money, spend proportionally more money on lobbying, have less power to oppose, for example, charter schools. What are your thoughts about the effect that Janus will actually have on workers?
Well, you know, it's very interesting because what you described was certainly the hope of the Right to Work Foundations and the Republican Party and the corporate leaders and the five Supreme Court justices, of course, who created really an entirely bogus category of speech to justify this decision that they don't apply to corporations or anybody else. But early on, the impact has been very, very low. There have been very few numbers of members who have left their unions. In some cases, union membership has grown as the threat to the union contract becomes more real. Right now, so far, at least to this point, unions have been able to develop this to some extent as a rallying point to sign up new members. It depends on the individual union. I think some unions that have relatively low membership rates are going to struggle, particularly if they don't have, you know, significant money in savings, let's say, to continue to employ an executive director for 40 hours a week, just as one example of this. Long term, I think that what this is that, you know, Janus begins what's going to be many Supreme Court cases to continue to undermine union rights. And I think the big fear for me going forward is cases that limit what unions can bargain for in the public sector, which is what, you know, the state of Wisconsin passed when it passed a right to work to bill, and Iowa did the same thing, that really limits how much unions can bargain over, which really de-incentivizes the reason that unions exist, de-incentivizes why a worker would join a union. So that's definitely a big concern going forward. But in the short term, it has not led to the feared catastrophe.
What are your thoughts about employees that would like to unionize? Vox just ran a piece last week about Amazon warehouse workers in New York that are trying to unionize. A group of employees from the company's warehouse in Staten Island announced the plan with organizers from the retail, wholesale, and department store union. Employees there say we're not robots, we're human beings. I mean, we're seeing Amazon strikes really around the world. Germany I heard on Democracy Now! This morning that Amazon workers in Germany are going on strike. And then Gizmodo released an anti-union video. It's a 45-minute video that Amazon's putting out. So what about efforts to unionize, especially at Amazon, which now owns Whole Foods?
Yeah, well, of course, Whole Foods itself was a tremendously anti-union company. Their founder, extremely anti-union, and so in some way that fits its sale to Amazon. I think that, Amazon is becoming, obviously, this global monopoly over a number of different parts of our economy. And based around that, and because the working conditions are poor, and because they are trying to go global, it really does open up the possibility for unionization. You know, I think there's a lot of fear in the United States over unionization, and there's a reason for that. And that's because that employers have basically taken over the collective bargaining process, really engaging in what we would call regulatory capture over the National Labor Relations Board. In other words, it's become very, very difficult by placing pro-business people in this process. It becomes very difficult to actually win a union contract. Employers have the ability to bombard employees with anti-union propaganda, just like that 45-minute video that you described. And, you know, labor law is weak. The fear of getting fired is high. These are significant problems and have been big problems for some time. And is a big reason why unions have declined in the United States. But I do feel that we are in a moment where more and more people are stepping up to demand a dignity for themselves. They're seeing unions as a potential way to do this. And that, you know, the more strikes that happen, these teacher strikes and hotel strikes and everything else, the more this is in the news, the more it gives courage to those who are trying to stand up for themselves. And so I think that because Amazon is such a public-facing company, that a strong, strong anti-union campaign may well backfire against them. They're going to face a lot of publicity. They've become the big boys now, and just like an Apple or a McDonald's, they've become the face of a huge sector of the economy, and everything they do is going to be scrutinized. And so if they engage in aggressive union busting, that's going to be a major story. So I am somewhat optimistic, and I think the international nature of this, the fact that unions are strong in Germany and these German workers are leading the way here, gives me hope that American Amazon workers may unionize as well.
Well, if anyone's interested in this anti-union Amazon video that Gizmodo got its hands on, we'll put a link at yourcallradio.org. Today, we're speaking to Eric Loomis, Associate Professor of History at the University of Rhode Island and author of the book, A History of America in 10 Strikes. Just coming up shortly, we will speak with a Kaiser-licensed social worker who went on strike last week, and we'll also speak with a Marriott housekeeper who went on strike. If you'd like to join us, what are your thoughts about the strikes that we've seen this year, about efforts to unionize? We'd love to hear from you. If you have participated in a strike this year or any time in the past, what was it like for you? What was the result? And if you have any questions about the state of workers today, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Eric, when you look at the tactics that workers take when they strike, whether you're looking at the masses of teachers that went on strike, or the fast food workers that walked off the job, the Marriott hotel workers, the Kaiser mental health workers, what would you say strikes you? And is there any way to say what is most effective? I mean, every strike obviously is very different. The demands are different. But generally, what would you say is most effective?
Well, I think that right now what's most effective is the way that they've so effectively connected their personal issues and demands up with the larger problems of a community. You know, so I look at, for instance, the teacher strikes, right? You know, and yes, the teachers are paid very low and they're demanding more money. But that is deeply connected to other issues in the schools and in the community that builds public support for them. And so if you're a teacher and you're making only $40,000 a year or $41,000 a year, and you live in a place that is, you know, of even moderate of you know, moderately expensive, there's no way that you can only work one job. And so, you know, you can, you know, so these teachers unions have done a great job, say, connecting up the fact that they're having to teach extra jobs and thus work extra jobs, excuse me, and thus not being as prepared for class as they'd like to be, not being as awake and aware, and not being able to spend the kind of time with students that they would prefer to, that is actually their goal, the reason they're into teaching is because of their love of students. That connects up very closely with parents who are concerned about their children's education. And, you know, then when that gets connected up with things like overall school funding and smaller class sizes, which have been major parts of the strike demands in West Virginia and elsewhere, this becomes a very effective way to build alliances. So it's not just, oh, here's some greedy teachers demanding more money. It's here's these impoverished yet respected members of our community standing up for themselves and standing up for our children. And I think that is very, very effective. And I think we've seen that in some of these other strikes as well. I mean, you know, some of the hotel worker strikes, for instance, some of their demands have revolved around sexual harassment issues because, you know, these workers are very vulnerable to sexual harassment in these hotel rooms. And being able to connect that up with a larger Me Too movement is a great way to show how this is really a community-based struggle. You know, McDonald's, certainly everybody knows McDonald's workers are paid terribly, and these tend to be, you know, low-income workers, workers of color, and it connects back into the larger themes of economic opportunity and injustice in those communities. And so I think the fact that all of these strikes are really community-based is a great, great way to go forward, and I think is part of the reason I feel very optimistic right now.
Eric Loomis is Associate Professor of History at the University of Rhode Island and author of A History of America in 10 Strikes. On today's Your Call, we are talking about this year's strikes and efforts to unionize. And now I would like to welcome Clem Papazian to the show. Clem is a licensed social worker at Kaiser in Oakland, California. He has been with Kaiser for 30 years. Last year, we spoke with one of Clem's colleagues in Roseville, California, about their 5-day strike to draw attention to long wait times their patients experience, sometimes 2 months for a follow-up therapy appointment. We're talking about people who need therapy every week, and they have to wait 2 months. Kaiser's mental health workers are also demanding better working conditions. Hi, Clem. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yes, hi. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really pleased to be on your show.
Well, it's great to have you, Clem. Before we dive in and talk about the Kaiser strike, I just want to talk to you more generally about unions, because we've been spending the first part of the show just about unions, the history of unions. And I understand that Kaiser workers unionized back in 2000 because of all of these problems. We spoke earlier, Clem, and you said you were drawn somewhat kicking and screaming to the labor movement back in 2000. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. I mean, mental health workers, for the most part, you know, they're professionals, they're highly educated folks who haven't historically seen themselves as labor, traditional labor. The real issues at Kaiser come down to these clinicians who go to school and train to do this very specific kind of work where they're caring for people at their darkest times. They were effectively prevented from doing that work in the way that they were trained by the system at Kaiser. And so over many, many years, this has been a prominent issue within the Kaiser system. And the mental health workers, I think there was 3 attempts at unionizing, and in 2000, we ultimately unionized with 57% of the membership. But slowly it became clearer and clearer that this was kind of, as your last speaker had noted, this is a compelling moral, ethical, and social interest that we felt that the union could be very effective in helping galvanize driving our interests forward with the employer.
Clem, you have been at Kaiser for 30 years. You all unionized back in 2000. How have your views about the power of striking, collective bargaining, and expressing solidarity with fast food workers, for example, really changed over the last 18 years?
Well, again, I would say, like your earlier caller may have mentioned, that, you know, having a compelling moral and ethical and social interest like the teachers, like the mental health workers have with relation to, you know, their mission, that really has kind of galvanized the public support. And anybody who, 50% of the population is, in California, is covered by Kaiser. Half of those people have used mental health services. And anybody who's used mental health services realizes the truth of what it is that we're saying and have been saying for the last 8 years. And so the power of the union to really help us focus these issues, both in the eyes of the mental health community and in the eyes of the public, has been phenomenal. And so it really speaks to the power of organized labor and their skills in organizing, in research, in using the regulatory environment to really drive those issues forward. And I think by definition, then, there is solidarity with other groups of workers who really struggle with very similar kinds of constraints. The teachers come to my mind most powerfully.
And Clem, your union is the National Union of Healthcare Workers.
That's right. And they came to us roughly in 2010, and really had a background of tremendous institutional experience. Their leaders really were prominent in the SEIU UHW for many years, and there was a schism of philosophy with the national organization, and they ended up forming NUHW in 2010, and we saw that as an opportunity really to work with some terrific leaders, and then in a what I like to term a opportunity of symbiosis, their success as a union was tied to our success in our mental health crisis at Kaiser.
Clem, you and a few colleagues wrote an opinion piece for the San Jose Mercury News called "Kaiser Mental Health Workers Explain Why They're Striking." And you pointed out that Kaiser reported almost $4 billion in profits last year and gave its CEO a $6 million pay increase. Again, for people who are outside of the state, Kaiser is a health plan that's used by millions of people in California, as Clem just mentioned. How many million again, Clem?
Well, this particular CEO, it earns $16 million a year.
$16 million. And how many Californians have Kaiser for their health insurance in California?
It's the largest health insurer in the state. So I don't know the exact number, but it's the largest in the state.
So the CEO is paid $16 million a year, and yet Kaiser employs just one full-time equivalent mental health clinician for every 3,000 members in the state. A lot of people really need therapy once a week, but the wait times can be 2 months. And we're going to definitely do a show more about this in the new year. Clem, you all went on a 5-day strike last year up and down the state. We invited Kaiser to join us last week, but they never got back to us. Mm-hmm. What's the status of your, you know, the strike and your demands? What are you hearing from Kaiser?
Well, what we're hearing from Kaiser is that they feel that they have increased staffing. They feel that their sense is that this is really about wages for mental health workers. I can tell you that Kaiser, yes, they did indeed increase the amount of therapists that they've deployed, but in no way does it come anywhere close to their demand. Their demand has skyrocketed, and our feeling is that the organization really has no interest in improving the mental health services to the degree that is required, because we've been at this for 8 years, and what we've seen is a steady increase in demand, but no real proportional increase in the staffing. The wages that that they've offered, what we're saying is just that they keep up with what's fair, what they've given to the other unions, and this is really not a wage issue. This is really about staffing with a meaningful resource that is far, far in lack of proportion to what's really needed.
Well, we're going to do a roundtable in the new year, Clem, to talk about the importance of therapy, because after we did our Kaiser show last week, I heard from a number of therapists who do not work for Kaiser and said that this crisis is really across the board. It's not just Kaiser. So, Clem, thank you so much for taking the time to join us, and we'll be in touch in the new year. Thank you.
You bet. Take care now. Bye-bye.
You too. Clem Papazian is a licensed social worker at Kaiser in Oakland, California. He has been with Kaiser for 30 years. He dedicates his life to really helping people. And Kaiser workers went on strike last week because people who need therapy sometimes have to wait up to 2 months to get an appointment. We will definitely follow that strike, and we'll find out what's happening there and find out if Kaiser's going to respond. Coming up after the break, we'll continue speaking with Eric Loomis, Associate Professor of History at the University of Rhode Island and author of A History of America in 10 Strikes. Today, we are talking about this year's strikes and efforts to unionize. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on Your Call, on the phone, by sending an email to yourcall@klw.org, or by going to the yourcallradio.org website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by phone, call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio. For some 75 years, this community has supported KALW, and because of listener support, it has grown into one of the most creative stations in public radio. Be part of KALW's future and save on your taxes by making a donation of stock. Information at kalw.org/support. Thanks.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to open the lines and find out about the greatest needs in your community and how you're giving back during the holidays. The need, as you know, is just so immense. Almost 40 million Americans live in poverty. More than 500,000 people are homeless. These are according to government numbers. Homeless advocates say the number is much higher. 40 million people struggle with hunger. There is so much need in the community, and because of government budget cuts and really an action, it's just so important to try to take action wherever you can. So we're going to open the lines to find out how you're doing that and to hear about your favorite nonprofits and groups doing good work. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are talking about the strikes that we've seen this year and efforts to unionize with Eric Loomis, Associate Professor of History at the University of Rhode Island and author of A History of America in 10 Strikes. You can join us 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We have an email from Art, who says, I am a retired union member. I've been on strike. I've seen labor organizing shut down by unfair labor practices by employers where the NLRB, National Labor Relations Board, process works. But getting justice with the NLRB regulation takes so long, and it's often an empty victory. I want to know what you think, Eric. The labor movement should be demanding in terms of labor law reform to make it easier to form and or join unions. Eric?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and I think it's one of the outstanding issues of the time. Unions have been arguing for the need for labor law reform for a very, very long time. In 2009, when President Obama took over, supposedly one of the top demands was going to be what was called the Employee Free Choice Act, which would allow workers or unions to organize a workplace rather than go through the burdensome union election process, which, as your emailer noted, can take years, that would speed it up through simply having a majority of workers who sign a union card. That's called card check. And unfortunately, that was not at the very top of President Obama's agenda. That combined with the unprecedented radicalism of the Republican opposition and the decision by people such as Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan and John Boehner simply to shut down everything Democrats could possibly do through an unprecedented use of congressional institutions to slow agendas down, doomed the Employee Free Choice Act. Basically, if you look at the Obama administration after the stimulus package and the Affordable Care Act, that was about it. As far as major legislative victories, and not only card check, but also the climate cap and trade bill and other things that people thought was going to be passed was sacrificed. And so this was this is a critical issue, and that is the Employee Free Choice Act, or a new version of it, is still absolutely on the agenda. But I think we also have to think creatively. I don't think that even, a revived Employee Free Choice Act and making it easier to unionize is really enough. I think we have to advocate for new laws and processes around the way that labor elections take place, the ability of employers to be able to hold captive union meetings, create the kind of anti-union videos that you were discussing earlier. I think that we need new kinds of election processes. In many ways, I feel like we have to really start from scratch with labor law. And frankly, it's time. The United States has not passed a comprehensive labor law bill in 80 years. The last big labor law bill that was pro-labor, there's been anti-labor laws that have been passed. The last big pro-labor legislation to pass Congress on a comprehensive basis was the Fair Labor Standards Act in 1938 that created the minimum wage, the 8-hour day, and overtime pay, and all of that. And so we have an antiquated system that employers have fully captured, and we really need, I think, as a movement, to rethink this from the beginning. And I think the greater use of direct action strikes to raise the stakes is very potentially part of that solution. But I think we're at a very beginning point in this process.
Eric, when we do shows about workers and many other issues, I just feel like we need a workers' party, because I mean, when you look at the Democratic Party and how closely so many of them are aligned with big business and corporations, even Obama said that he would walk with workers when they went on strike, and he never did. I mean, Wisconsin was a great opportunity, and he never did it. So, what are your thoughts about that? Because the fact of the matter is, you need strong laws to protect people.
The problem with, and I will say that I am a strong opponent of a workers or labor party, not because I believe in the Democratic Party. That's not it at all. But because as a historian, we have 200 years of examples, over 200 years of examples about how the American political system works. And the reality is that in the structure of the American political system, there is not space for three parties. If somehow a system was created where perhaps you had five or six parties, maybe there would be, but we have a winner-take-all political system. We do not have a coalitional political system like you often have in Europe, where you have different parties and then they may align to form a government. Here it's winner-take-all. And so if you have a strong workers' party that is pulling 15 to 20% of the vote, let's say, almost all of that is going to come from the Democratic Party, which is going to lead to Republican dominance for many, many years. And so there really just is – they're not – functional examples of third parties that are able to break into the two-party system for very long at all. And so that's one piece of it. The other is that to start and organize a third party takes so much organizing and so much energy that it's actually probably easier to take over the Democratic Party than it is to start a third party. And I think that with people such as, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is one example, who it was able to, you know, win a primary election against a pretty lame corporate Democrat, become a voice of the people, expose what's going on in Washington, start raising demands for a Green New Deal, et cetera. She's making a significant change already to our political discourse, working through what is admittedly a problematic Democratic Party. The reality, though, is that this stuff takes time. I mean, you're talking about at least a 10 to 15 year period. And I think that what people have to understand is the Republican Party did not get the way it is today overnight. This was a 60 to 70 year process of hardcore right-wing conservatives taking over what was once a fairly diverse political party and turning it into what it is today. And it was through organizing, right-wing organizing, but nonetheless, grassroots organizing with, yes, tons of money from rich people, yes, but still grassroots organizing to drive out moderates and turn the modern Republican Party into a radical right-wing party. And that's the reality of the probably the best way. That's the best example in modern American history of how grassroots organizing has led to political change. It's on the right, not on the left.
Right. Well, we can dream about a workers' party, but you're totally right about the two-party system. It's just, I mean, look what happened to the Green Party. So, yeah, we're going to do a show in January or February about some of the new progressive members of the Democratic Party to find out what they plan to accomplish. And like you said, it's like a 10 to 15 year, maybe 20 year plan if you really want to take over the Democratic Party. Eric Loomis is Associate Professor of History at the University of Rhode Island and author of A History of America in 10 Strikes. On today's Your Call, we are talking about this year's strikes. We're talking about worker uprisings, efforts to unionize. And now I would like to welcome back to the show Lara Lou Karumba. She is a housekeeper with Marriott. And we've been covering this for the last month. Marriott workers went on a long strike in 8 cities. They recently signed new contracts after striking for raises and affordable health care in San Francisco. The strike continued for 2 months before Marriott settled. Hi, Lara Lou. Welcome back to the show.
Hello, thank you.
Hi, thank you so much for joining us. Lara Lou, last time you were on the show, we mentioned a really great San Francisco Examiner piece that was written about you. 5 days a week, you would lead dozens of your coworkers in a march outside of the Marriott Hotel in San Francisco. You've worked as a housekeeper for 6 years. Now that you've been able to finally take a break from the strike and you signed a contract, you know, what are your overall thoughts about what you all accomplished?
We really accomplished a lot. I mean, in terms of our contract, in terms of our health insurance, our pension, it all went well because of the strike.
And Lara Lou, you and so many other colleagues work 2 to 3 jobs because you couldn't make ends meet on your salary from Marriott. With this new contract, will you be able to just work at Kaiser? At Marriott?
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Because the work that I have, like the DoorDash, it will compensate with the new contract that I have when you total what the money that I will get from the new contract. I mean, I can eliminate my second job and just concentrate with my job in Marriott so that I can take care of my kids already and I have time for myself too.
Wow, that's amazing, Lara Lou. Just to remind listeners, when Lara Lou was on a couple of weeks ago, she talked about driving for the food delivery service DoorDash, and she had to bring her children with her as she delivered food. So that's amazing, Lara Lou. You can now just focus on your job at Marriott and actually spend your time off with your family.
Yes, that's why I'm very happy, because I will no longer drive with a DoorDash with my kids having their dinner at the back of the seat, and they can take a rest after school and do their homework, and we spend more time together.
That's amazing, Larry Liu. What would you say to other workers who are going on strikes? The fast food workers, for example, Amazon workers, Whole Food workers who want to unionize. What would you say to them? And, you know, when you think about the lessons that you learned from your successful strike?
I can tell them that they just continue fighting, because when you know that you're fighting for what is right, you can get it. Whatever it takes, they just need to have patience, and they just need to work together, and they will get what they want.
Larry Liu, the other thing I wanted to ask you about just briefly, but we're going to do a show about this in the new year, is the new contract you all negotiated included protections on sexual assault. Hotel workers who have one-on-one contact with guests carry silent GPS-enabled panic buttons, and they trigger an intervention from hotel security. So if a guest makes advances or does something inappropriate, the guest will be evicted immediately. I mean, it's horrible that you all have to have this, but it's about time that this is included in the contract. Can you talk about the significance of that win?
Yes, it is very important for us, because when we work, nobody sees us, especially when we're already doing our own assignments. We do our assignment all by ourselves, and if the guest is inside the room and they harass us, nobody can see us, because we are all busy working our own assignments. So it's very important that we get that, and so that also the guest knows that when they did something wrong, they cannot go to that particular hotel anymore, and they will be black in the list. And it's very important for us, because it protects us more. And when I'm doing my job, I will have a peace of mind that nobody will do something bad about me, because they would be afraid to. And I have this equipment that somebody will rescue me when something happens.
Well, Larry Liu, we hope you never have to use it, but really it's about time.
Yeah, I hope
so. Yes. But it's about time that these panic buttons are in the contract, and that you all have them. Before we let you go, Larry Liu, you were all in San Francisco in front of the Marriott. You went on strike for 2 months, and you were every day out in the cold, out in the rain. People were drumming all day long. I mean, it was really loud. It's very taxing. What would you say to others about keeping up that momentum and keeping it going?
It's really hard to be on strike, doing those chanting, doing those drums, and it's really very loud, and my eardrums is already broken for that. But yeah, it really helps us. It is really very hard, especially when it's raining, and then those fires comes, and I still need to chant in spite that the smoke is there. It's really hard, but it really helps us, because that way they can hear us, what we really want.
What were some of the conversations you had with people who either went into the hotel or people who passed by?
Come again?
What were the conversations like when you were striking with people who either had a reservation at the hotel or people who passed by?
You know what? Even the guests from the hotel, they always, whenever they pass by, they have their thumbs up, and some are get angry, but most of them are really is really with us. They keep on shouting. They also shout with us. And one time, one guest from the hotel came to our line and hold the the sign, and then he picket with us. And then some of them, they give donation. Like when they go out of the hotel, they will buy bread and they will give it to us. We really appreciate them. Though some of them are really, really get angry with the noise, but some of the guests understand us, and they usually say, keep on fighting.
Well, Lara Lou, thank you so much for joining us, and I hope you and your family have a nice holiday. Thank you.
You too. Thank you so much.
Lara Lou Karumba is a Marriott housekeeper. She was involved in the two-month strike at Marriott in San Francisco. Laura Waxman at the San Francisco Examiner wrote a profile of Lara Lou, who had to work 2 to 3 jobs just to make ends meet. But thanks to the new contract they recently signed, she now just works at Marriott and she can actually spend time with her family. We should say that there were strikes at Marriott in 8 cities across the country, and workers recently signed new contracts for raises and affordable health care. And you can find more information about that, yourcallradio.org. And for the next 5 or so minutes, we're still with Eric Loomis, Associate Professor of History at the University of Rhode Island and author of A History of America in 10 Strikes. I mean, Eric, it's really amazing to talk to Lara Lou and other women especially, everybody, but there was so many women and women of color who are doing back-breaking work, changing beds, cleaning rooms all day long. I mean, some people have to go to the emergency room because it's grueling work. And it's just incredible to talk to Lara Lou and learn that now she can just work one job and she's able to make ends meet on that.
Well, right. And I think that her experience and the experience of all of these workers in these strikes, shows what the American working class really looks like, too. I mean, so much of our media attention, especially after the election of Donald Trump, focused on, white working class men in Ohio and Pennsylvania and why they might have voted for Donald Trump. And while that's a perfectly legitimate line of inquiry, where is the media attention on these immigrant workers from Guatemala and El Salvador and Mexico who are doing the essential work of America every day, cleaning our hotels, hotel rooms, taking care of our children, taking care of our elderly, building our homes. I mean, this is the actual American working class. It's people of color, and their experiences are simply not given enough attention in the American media. And the struggles of these workers in these strikes demonstrates the lengths that they are now willing to go to get their voices heard. And these are really inspiring stories. Anytime people can organize for change, it's inspiring. But when it especially are people from traditionally oppressed groups, and especially immigrants and women and people of color, these stories are even more inspiring because they are the stories that made America as great as it's ever been.
And at least these workers, the Marriott workers, the Kaiser workers, they do have the protection of a union. What about the workers who don't have the protection of a union? I mean, just to give a shout out to all of the fast food workers, mostly low income people of color. I'm reading a piece right now about the McDonald's workers who went on strike back in September over sexual harassment. They went on strike in 10 cities. I mean, the stories are horrific about how, customers proposition them. They make graphic sexual comments about them. And yet these workers, they don't have the protection of a union.
Well, and the vast majority of American workers don't.
Right.
union rates are barely over 10%. So the vast majority of workers are very easily exploited. And that is everything really, from your office workers, your middle managers at a business, all the way down to your fast food workers. The idea of collective action has been largely lost for millions of American workers. And for those, workers who have very little power over their lives, workers who are at the, lower end of the socioeconomic scale and are just struggling to make ends meet, any act of organizing is a serious act of personal bravery. And these workers at places like McDonald's, who don't have the protections of a union, they are engaging in enormous acts of bravery, much more so than most of us will ever take in our lives, putting their livelihood at risk to stand up for their rights. And I think that ultimately, there are two lessons. One is that the best thing you can do to help you yourself live a better life is to form and join a union. And secondly, is that no matter whether we have unions or not, workers are still at some level going to stand up and fight for what they think is right. And that will happen no matter what the courts or the political system or anybody else does to the labor movement. Workers will always stand up for what they think is right.
And it's also important to emphasize what so many women of color face on the job, especially jobs that don't pay much. We're talking about fast food workers, janitors, farm workers, and they really need protections from sexual assault. I mean, we've done a lot of shows about this year. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers in Florida, they have been on the forefront of demanding better strategies for preventing sexual assault for farm workers in the fields, and the same applies to janitors.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, economic exploitation, racial exploitation, sexual exploitation, they all merge together. An exploitative system takes advantage of people in any number of ways. And sexual harassment has always been a major issue for women at the workplace, going all the way back to the early 19th century factories. Sexual exploitation has been a central issue in American labor history. It is unfortunately not talked about as often enough as a workplace issue, but it is as central to the reality of the workplace for half or more of the workforce as wages and hours and other forms of working conditions. And so, protection from sexual exploitation and harassment is absolutely should be a central demand of all of the labor movement.
Eric, we have about a minute or so left. So many people have been inspired by what they saw this year. A lot of people are learning about labor history. Clem, earlier in the show, the social worker at Kaiser told me, quote, "I've been forged into a person who understands the importance of withdrawing one's labor as a strong tool to get the attention of the employer," end quote. What are your thoughts about what we can expect in 2019?
I think you're going to see more strikes. I think that more teachers are going to strike. You're already Denver teachers are talking about striking, for instance. There's news of this in Louisiana. Los Angeles may well, in fact, go on strike in 2019. I think you're going to see more strikes in fast food, more strikes in healthcare, other hotel workers potentially, and other sectors that we don't expect. The more strikes that happen, they have a building effect on each other by giving people confidence that these strikes can be won. And so I absolutely think that 2019 is going to be a relatively major year for strikes, at least compared to other years over the last decade or two.
Eric Loomis is Associate Professor of History at the University of Rhode Island and author of A History of America in 10 Strikes. Eric, thanks for your work. We'd love to have you back to talk about your book. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to open the lines to find out about the greatest needs in your community and find out how you're giving back during the holidays. If there is an organization or nonprofit that's doing really amazing work, shoot us an email and we'll talk about it tomorrow. yourcall@kalw.org. Laura Wenis produced today's show. Thank you, Laura. And thanks to David LaTulipe, our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.